This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Spotlight on Africa, Niger, Somalia, and Kenya's election rerun. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. U.S. Special Forces personnel in Somalia train local troops fighting the Shabab Islamist group, providing intelligence and sometimes going into battle with them. On October 14th, a massive attack, widely attributed to the Shabab in Mogadishu, killed more than 350 people, which disturbingly illustrates the group's increased reach. In Niger, an ambush on October 4th left four U.S. Army Special Forces soldiers, also known as Green Berets, dead. That ambush was more complex than first reported and quickly became a political issue in Washington. America's operations in conflict zones like Africa are expanding. Overall, the United States has over 6,000 military personnel operating in 53 countries in Africa. Most operate in three locations, about 4,000 in Djibouti, between 800 to 1,000 in Niger, and another 400 in Somalia. Djibouti is an important logistics planning, naval, and aviation hub for U.S. forces on the continent. Niger and Somalia are direct action areas where embedded U.S. units train and fight alongside local forces on counterterrorism and counterinsurgency missions. In Kenya, the country's Supreme Court failed to hold a hearing that could have postponed the election rerun, slated to have gone forward on October 26th. Thursday's vote was the second try this year to elect a president. In an unprecedented move, the Supreme Court threw out results of the August 8th election because of what it called irregularities and illegalities. Opposition leader Raila Odinga, who withdrew his candidacy from the repeat poll, called on his supporters to protest what they perceive are ongoing problems with the Election Commission. Well, joining us to discuss U.S. national security strategy in Africa, especially in the wake of tragic events in Niger and Somalia, as well as the implications of Kenya's election do-over, are two distinguished regional analysts. J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and the Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based here in Washington, and Joshua Meservey. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, also a think tank based in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, Peter Pham, let me begin with you. Let's step back a minute and describe for us how you see U.S. national security challenges in Africa. What are the threats and challenges facing the United States and our local partners?
First and foremost, the threat is the threat to security, ordinary lives of men, women, and children, and the security of states in the region, which are our partners. Threats presented by violent extremism, Islamist terrorism. And we see that very, very clearly in the Sahel. And of course, there are also threats to political, diplomatic, and other interests by other actors across the continent. But first and foremost, there is that security threat, and that's probably what brings us to these mics today.
Joshua, anything to add or subtract to the overall challenges that we face in Africa?
No, I think Dr. Pham hit the major points. I will say that thus far, we've been fortunate in that most of the terrorism issues springing from Africa haven't been a direct threat to the U.S. homeland, but it's something we have to remain vigilant about.
Back to you, Peter Pham. Let's go straight to what happened in Niger recently. How do you see the U.S. mission in Niger, and how do you interpret what happened with the tragic death of four U.S. Green Beret, given the murky circumstances?
The U.S. mission in Niger has evolved over the years. If we go back to the presidency of President George W. Bush, Niger has been a founding partner with the United States in security initiatives throughout the region. First, the Pan-Sahel Initiative, then the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Initiative, then Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership, and as it has evolved. So it's been a long-standing partner with the United States in efforts in this region. Then back in 2013, President Obama deployed a small number, at that time roughly 100 personnel there, to set up and man a drone base in the capital of Niamey. Subsequently, more U.S. personnel were deployed to the country first to, once an agreement was reached, to build another drone facility in Agadez in the center of the country, where it could survey not only the Sahara, but also southern Libya and other parts closer in the central part of Africa. And then subsequently, further deployments of intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, so-called ISR personnel to help with the fight against Boko Haram in the southeastern part of the country. The picture you're probably getting is this is a country with challenges on all sides, and that's precisely why the mission has developed. And most recently, it's been in the northwestern part of the country, which borders Mali and Burkina Faso, where there is operational a large al-Qaeda-linked umbrella group, as well as, regrettably, as we now know, also a Daesh or ISIS-linked group.
Again, Joshua, your take on what the U.S. mission is in Niger, who our partners are, and specifically, what are we facing? What are the locals facing?
The locals are facing really a kaleidoscope of terrorist organizations that operate in that region. As Dr. Pham correctly pointed out, that's why the U.S. mission has evolved. That's why there's been such a noticed increase in activity in Niger. You look at the neighborhood in which Niger sits, you have very active al-Qaeda affiliates, and again, now you have ISIS increasingly flexing their muscles in that region. I would want to caution that there's been some speculation that this was somehow a secret mission or something of that nature. And no doubt there are tactical components of the mission that were secret, but this is a fairly well-known operation in that it's been widely reported in the open source, and it's very typical of how special operations operate on the continent. We do advise and assist missions all over, and AFRICOM has said that we have troops that are active in 53 of the 54 African countries. Gives you a sense of the extent of our activities there.
Exactly. Well, back to you, Peter Pham, to assess the circumstances surrounding the ambush and death of the U.S. servicemen. How do you see what may have gone wrong with that particular operation, given what we know thus far?
If I can take a step back, Carol, I think it's important to also point out in this context, and with all due humility and respect for the families of those who lost their lives and those who were injured, the fact that they were on a mission in this specific geographic area with Nigerian forces itself is a sign of remarkable progress. The U.S. Special Forces in the country have been helping. This is a country that at any index of socioeconomic well-being ranks absolute bottom or near the absolute bottom. And yet it's a country that's managed to hold credible, fair, internationally observed elections, had democratic transitions, that unlike some of its neighbors, Mali, for example, has managed to integrate some of the restive minority ethnic groups into the government. In fact, the prime minister of the country, Brigi Rafini, is an ethnic Tuareg. Tuareg secessionism isn't an issue in Niger. The battalion that the U.S. Special Forces was working with, Battalion Sécurité et Renseignement, Security and Intelligence Battalion, didn't exist a few years ago until, with the help of the U.S. and some of our European partners, gradually developed, was trained, and was now pursuing reconnaissance and other missions farther and farther afield from the capital, including in this area, which is very remote from the capital. It's an area, the Tillaberi Prefecture of Niger. It's very sparsely populated, and it's not the first mission, but it's the fact that they penetrate there and are able to be out there among the people, which is the only way you're going to get intelligence, etc., is itself remarkable. Now, on this specific mission, unfortunately, things went very wrong. They were ambushed on the 4th of October, and we have to await the investigation that the Pentagon, as it always does in after-action scenarios, to find out what exactly happened and what lessons can be learned.
Turning to you, Joshua, even though we have to wait for this investigation, even our own French to Africa service here at the Voice of America reported something very interesting and perhaps disturbing, saying that a local official and an analyst say that residents of the Niger village where the four Green Beret soldiers were killed may have delayed the soldiers while an ambush was set up and helped to lead the victims into a deadly trap. To what extent do you think there is this sort of collusion among locals in the village with extremist forces? And what does that say about the challenge that exists? To what extent does the death of the four U.S. soldiers in Niger reveal that these extremist groups, whether connected to al-Qaeda or ISIS, have an economic underpinning? Again, we have to look at all sides of how this transpired.
You're right. Those reports have been very concerning. Frankly, they're not terribly surprising. again, these are very remote communities that, unfortunately, many of these terrorist groups have access to. And they're quite diligent about trying to build the sorts of ties that might lead villagers to support them or give them operational, tactical information, things of that nature. That's actually exactly the reason why you need forces out in these areas, now meaning friendly forces, Nigerian and U.S. forces. You have to be out there in these remote areas where terrorists operate, talking to the villagers, building those ties, gathering the intel. You just cannot be effective in this context otherwise. Again, that's one of my concerns, that if there's further backlash around what happened, that the temptation might be to withdraw from this sort of activity or to hunker down or to otherwise curtail the sorts of training and advice in remote areas that U.S. forces do. And I think that would be a mistake. Clearly, we need to learn lessons from what happened. The Pentagon is already vigorously looking into this, and they will learn lessons, and I'm confident they'll implement them. But this is the sort of thing we need to be doing because terrorists are so active, particularly in remote areas where they know they can operate fairly safely, and they understand the importance of building ties with local communities. So U.S. forces and U.S. policymakers need to understand that same importance.
Quickly, before we go to a break, Peter Pham, how would you react to that? Do you think the United States and other allies perhaps rely too heavily on military tactics to defeat these extremists and not enough on, you know, economic development and other measures that would improve lives of villagers and make them less vulnerable, perhaps, to the persuasion of these extremist groups?
Certainly economic development, opportunity, political inclusion are all parts of the equation. But I would even add that perhaps we're often too reliant on signals intelligence or perhaps images sent by drones. One also has to have human intelligence. And the only way you're going to acquire that is to be out there. It's not just that the possibility exists, as these reports alluded to, of villagers perhaps actively acting against the U.S. Nigerian forces, but it could also well be a scenario where they're afraid because the government is not there. And these masked men and their motorbikes and guns are there day in and day out or just around the corner. So it could also be a passive acquiescence as well as an active collusion.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. And Joshua Meservey. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. We're discussing the recent terrorist attacks in Somalia, U.S. operations in Niger, and we will also touch on the second presidential election in Kenya. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Odoji Leleji. He describes himself as a passionate listener of our program. He's from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Well, we here at the VOA are passionate about you too, and we appreciate your feedback. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Peter Pham, and let's talk now about Somalia, the terrible tragedy that occurred there recently. The locals dubbed this attack their 9/11. What does this say about al-Shabaab and how the United States and allies are able to contain it? I mean, what are we to interpret from this horrific event?
One is that al-Shabaab certainly has suffered innumerable reversals in the last few years. It's lost the territorial control it once had over a good two-thirds of south-central Somalia. It's lost a good number of fighters and a number of leaders, some to airstrikes, others to defection. The former deputy head of Shabaab just a few months ago defected to the government. But despite all that, it's a resilient group. It is now adapting, not entirely giving up on military tactics, because the very day this attack occurred in Mogadishu, Shabaab forces also seized critical crossroads about 45 kilometers southwest of the city. So they're not giving up on the military tactics, but they're increasingly adopting these asymmetric terrorist tactics to delegitimize the government by showing that it can't protect people. This was the most horrific attack Somalia has ever suffered, with the 350-plus deaths, but it's not the first one. Not even the first one in Mogadishu. My count this year in Mogadishu, there were 32 separate car bombs detonated in Mogadishu. So that's a rhythm that's you know, literally 1 a week.
Joshua, to what do you attribute this October 14th attack? Were you surprised? What does it say about al-Shabaab's strength and perhaps shortcomings in the U.S. and allied strategy to combat them?
I wasn't surprised by the attack. Al-Shabaab has proven time and again that they are a sophisticated, committed, and resilient terrorist organization. And they have carried out a string of attacks for many years inside of Mogadishu, outside, wherever really there's a target of opportunity. I think one interesting aspect of this particular attack is that it was somewhat of a mistake. It appears that they were going for another target, probably the UN compound. And the truck bomb was stopped, and so they ended up detonating in a heavily populated area. Now, al-Shabaab doesn't shy from killing civilians. They happily do it. But I think the reason they have not claimed this attack yet, even though it almost certainly is them, and I think the reason is that they realized that this was too many. This was an overreach, and they killed too many people. There's been demonstrations in the streets against al-Shabaab, things of that nature. And in the past, when they've launched really devastating attacks, I'm thinking of the Shamo Hotel attack several years ago, where they bombed a graduation ceremony, and there was a public outcry. They claimed they had not been involved. I think in that sense, I'm not surprised, but I think it does show that they made a bit of a mistake here. They're trying to walk it back. Now, what does this say about our, meaning the U.S.'s, involvement in the country? I don't think this is the time for any major rethinks. I think that this is something we knew about al-Shabaab, or we should have known about al-Shabaab, that they are capable of these sorts of attacks, that they will happily carry them out. Rebuilding Somalia is going to be a long, slow, uncertain process. And we know that al-Shabaab will continue these sorts of attacks. We have to be prepared for them. We have to learn from every single one. And fundamentally, we have to get the Somali government to deliver a measure of security, to be accountable to their citizens, to provide a framework for reconciliation, things of that nature. Whether this current Somali government can do it is very much an open question, and early returns have not been too encouraging.
How do you see that, Peter Pham, with respect to the Somali government being accountable, providing security?
I would make just 2 points complementary to what Joshua just said. One is we have to establish real benchmarks for progress with this government. And Joshua recently wrote an excellent report, which I would commend, which lays out some possible benchmarks that we should use to look at this government, because there are some real shortcomings. Secondly, however, looking at ourselves, what we and our other international partners can do, we've certainly been effective in direct action and in training. There's nothing to walk back there. And in fact, the U.S.'s airstrikes have been effective in eliminating key Shabaab leaders. We've decimated their leadership ranks, and ordinary fighters might be replaceable. Senior leaders with training and background aren't as easily come by. That's been good. That's been on the military side of the ledger. We also need to look at police and intelligence. Now, a lot of the burden is on the Somalis, but the international community needs to also provide that, because you're not going to stop a truck bombing with military means. It's intelligence, good policing skills are going to be required. And I think there the international community could be a little more robust. It's not saying that the U.S. should do it. Perhaps in many respects, we're not as well equipped to do that because we don't have a national police force. We have national militaries, but we don't have a national police. But certainly some of our European friends and others could step up to the plate.
Anything to add or subtract to that, Joshua, since you wrote the report on combating al-Shabaab and bringing stability to Somalia, what's missing from our strategy?
Yeah, I think this accountability piece has primarily been missing. And this plagues U.S. policy, I think, across the continent and even beyond, really. But the Somali government has to understand that continued U.S. support, diplomatic, financial, military support, is contingent on them delivering what we discussed earlier, the good governance and things of that nature. So the U.S. really needs to remain committed to that, because otherwise an open-ended, non-contingent commitment to this government will, in my opinion, fuel corruption and be ultimately counterproductive.
So should we threaten to withhold funds?
I think in some circumstances, yes. We need to have these benchmarks. We need to communicate them clearly to the Somali government. And then if they don't reach them, we need to look at the various levers that we have for encouraging them to do better the next time.
And as we close the program, Peter Pham, we turn now to Kenya, which has to be a linchpin in terms of security in the Horn of Africa with respect to Somalia. And yet, we're seeing some political instability. We have an election that went forward, a second election, but without the main opposition candidate. Raila Odinga boycotted the election. He won in a sense, on the first round because it was annulled by the Supreme Court, and yet he declined to participate. Why did he do that? Was that wise? And what are the implications?
First of all, Raila Odinga is a perennial candidate. He's 72 years old. This is his nth run at the presidency and probably his last. So his opponent, the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, is 55. And there have been rivalries between the two political dynasties for some time. So this is an old, old fight for Kenyans. Let's be honest and candid. There are also ethnic dimensions to this. What was interesting in the lead up to the August 8th poll, polling consistently showed that the incumbent president had roughly a 10-point lead on the challenger. That tightened a little bit toward the end. Then election day, most international observers, including the U.S. observation team led by former Secretary of State John Kerry, found that the polling and the voting process was credible and largely trouble-free with a few minor glitches here and there. It was only after losing by 54-44 that Mr. Odinga brought a case to the Kenyan Supreme Court. Surprising ruling, because it had never occurred in Africa, annulled the election results in order to rerun, saying there were imperfections. As an analyst, I found the court legal opinion a little mystifying, because if the elections were bad, why is it that only the presidential race was annulled and not the legislative and county-level race? The court has never explained itself, but it ordered new elections, which were scheduled to take place originally October 17th, but then moved to October 26th. I think Raila Odinga was making several calculations. He will say that he was seeking changes in the Electoral Commission, and I think some of those arguments are fair ones to make. On the other hand, the president was facing the end of the president's term and elections had to be held. So elections went forward. The courts ordered not just the top candidates, but all the candidates in the last election, their names go on the ballot. And given that fact, and perhaps given the fact that there is no way of uniting all the opposition against the incumbent and knowing he would possibly face defeat numerically in the polls, Odinga decided to engage in a bit of brinkmanship and step back, thus delegitimizing whatever the poll result may be.
Brinksmanship, yet there probably are some good legitimate reasons why he was concerned about the legitimacy of the election, Joshua Mazurvey, that is Raila Odinga. On the other hand, he boycotted the election, the second round. How can this poll be much more representative or legitimate? And what are the implications? Are we going to see a lot of instability, violence, perhaps? And this cannot be good for Kenya and certainly not the region about which we were talking, the Horn of Africa.
I think, unfortunately, the chances that anyone will consider this most recent election to be credible are very, very slim. The opposition, led by Raila Odinga, even before the initial vote in August, had been making noises about how any sort of opposition defeat was likely evidence of rigging. You can't ever rule out rigging in a context like Kenya. Unfortunately, there is some history there. So some of the critiques are absolutely plausible, but some of the rhetoric I also found to be fairly irresponsible, let me say that, and including in the run-up to the second go-round. Even the chairman of Kenya's electoral board said in public that he felt that it was going to be very hard to hold a credible election the second time around. One of the electoral officials, she resigned, fled the country. She's now in the United States. She said that the electoral board was completely compromised by partisan politics and she couldn't be a part of it. So again, this comes back to, will anyone see this election as legitimate? And I think the answer is almost certainly no. The implications of that are really worrying. One of the reasons Kenya gets so much attention around election time is because, of course, they had the terrible post-election violence in 2007. Really, the country still hasn't recovered from. There's still internally displaced people from that violence inside of Kenya. It's extraordinary. And Kenya is a hugely important country in East Africa. It's a staunch American ally. It's a counterterrorism partner. It's an economic driver of the region. And already there have been some economic consequences to the instability, the unrest around the second go-around. Any sort of violence is going to really hurt this country and, by extension, hurt the United States, I would say.
I'm afraid on that pessimistic note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Joshua Mazurvey. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific analysis.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Keith Holmes. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter. on the Voice of America.